Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for any.
Good afternoon. It is 5:03, Monday, October 31st. I'm Martin Lemlin, and this is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners on our newscast and podcast on the internet.
Good evening. And it's time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Vancouver, federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We'll also be interviewing Courtney Loftus, the media coordinator from Stand UBC, a student-run organization here at UBC that promotes awareness of ongoing genocides in order to promote discussion among fellow students and Canadians and to mobilize our government into action. All this, plus your weekend weather forecasts, right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Occupy movements continued across the world over the weekend, and arrests of occupiers continued as well. Among them, two in Rochester, New York, dozens in Portland, Oregon, 39 in Austin, Texas. In Richmond, Virginia, another 12 were arrested early this morning. Work crews then used bulldozers to raise what was left of the then-empty camp. And in Denver, Colorado, 20 protesters were arrested and others injured in a violent confrontation with police. Irene Rodriguez reports.
Following an Occupy Denver rally Saturday, hundreds of police armed with clubs, rubber bullets, tear gas, and pepper spray moved into the Occupy site.
She could get trampled! See that? There's a person on the ground! Three cops just fell on her!
Several protesters were injured and said the police attack was unprovoked. 2 weeks ago, Denver's mayor ordered that occupiers remove tents from their first site in front of the state capitol. Protesters resisted, SWAT teams moved in, and 15 were arrested. Early Saturday, occupiers held a rally and recamped in downtown Denver. Occupiers say that they intend to stay and held a peace vigil Sunday night. Those arrested appeared in court by this morning. Most were charged with failing to obey a police order to disperse. But one protester is facing a felony charge of assault on a police officer. In a statement released yesterday, Denver's police department said that their officers demonstrated great restraint and professionalism as they were taunted and even physically assaulted. Irene Rodriguez, FSRN, Denver.
In addition to protesters, police also attacked several members of the press, including Irene Rodriguez. The reporters say they are considering legal action. In Tennessee, the ACLU filed a lawsuit today on behalf of Occupy Nashville protesters who were arrested Friday, saying that their rights to free speech and to assemble were violated. According to Doctors Without Borders, their staff in southern Somalia is treating patients who were injured in airstrikes that hit a camp housing internally displaced women and children. At least three people are dead and dozens injured, including more than 30 kids. Kenyan troops admit firing on the town, but insist the target was an al-Shabaab camp. Somali Prime Minister Abdiweli Mohamed Ali.
I have to have a full picture of what has happened. So if that's the case, there is going to be an unfortunate incident. and every loss of life is important for us.
The camp provides refuge to more than 7,000 Somalis suffering from rampant famine and drought. Kenyan troops entered Somalia in recent weeks in an attempt to push al-Shabaab back from the border. Today, officials from both Somalia and Kenya asked for international help fighting the insurgents and specifically mentioned the possibility of a NATO force. Today is the official end of NATO's operation on Libya. Almost 10,000 airstrikes were launched over 7 months. Lieutenant General Charles Bouchard led the international campaign after the U.S. handed off control. Bouchard says that all claims of NATO strikes killing civilians were false.
Every time that an allegation of civilian casualties was made, it was always of concern to me and always ensured that they were fully assessed. And at the end of the day, none of these claims proved to be true.
But according to the Campaign for Innocent Civilians in Conflict, NATO has not thoroughly investigated casualty claims. And Peter Bukert with Human Rights Watch says that revenge attacks on Gaddafi loyalists continue. Tawarga, once a town of 30,000, remains completely abandoned, and Bukert says that rebels will not allow residents to return. Human Rights Watch called for Libyan leaders to condemn revenge attacks and to unite local fighters under one civilian command. The Australian government ordered Qantas Airlines to return to the skies today after the airline grounded all flights Saturday. Tens of thousands of travelers were stranded worldwide. The move was part of an ongoing labor dispute. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard.
I do not accept that Qantas's only choice on Saturday was to take the extreme action of grounding all planes and leaving tens of thousands of passengers stranded. I do not accept that.
Pilots, as well as cabin and ground crew, have organized actions for more than a year over salary issues and corporate restructuring that could cut some 1,000 jobs. Rocket fire continued today along the border between Gaza and Israel. One Israeli died in rocket fire over the weekend. 12 Palestinians were killed in retaliatory airstrikes. The violence quieted last night, but rocket fire renewed today, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denied reports of a ceasefire. UNESCO members approved adding Palestine as an official member today, despite a warning from the U.S. that it would withhold about $70 million if it did so. The cut is required under a U.S. law that prevents funding any U.N. organization that grants Palestine a full membership. UNESCO is the cultural component of the U.N., tasked with promoting peace through international exchange. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at fsrn.org. I'm Martin Lumlin.
And I'm Ariel Fournier.
You're listening to News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM. These are your local headlines.
The first 163 charges have been recommended by police against 60 alleged looters and vandals in the Stanley Cup riot, Vancouver police announced on Monday morning. The charges still need to be assessed by Crown prosecutors before they are actually laid. Neil McKenzie, the spokesperson for the Crown Prosecutor Office, said during the announcement at Vancouver Police Headquarters, Chief Jim Chu said the charges were recommended after new image analysis technology was used to create a searchable database of 30,000 YouTube videos and Facebook images to enable police to find a matching evidence of suspects and crimes. That database allowed police to lay 37 additional charges against the first 60 suspects, which police might not have laid using more traditional police technology, said Chu.
BC Premier Christy Clark announced this morning that a $353 million capital plan to build and expand schools in several school districts. Clark made the announcement in Surrey, one of BC's fastest-growing school districts. She said there are school districts in our province that have experienced tremendous student enrollment growth in recent years and are in need of funds to expand current schools or build new ones. And this investment will also create more jobs, which is great news for BC families. Projects approved for funding include 6 new elementary schools, 1 new middle school, 2 new secondary schools, 4 school additions, 6 school site purchases, 4 of which are for future schools. The Surrey School District has been approved for 8 new projects, 2 new elementary schools, 2 secondary school additions, and a purchase of land for 4 future schools.
That is a lot of projects, Martin.
That's right. The $353 million plan will be spread over several school districts, including Sooke, where Education Minister George Abbott announced 2 new secondary schools just this morning. Other school districts have been approved for funding include Central Okanagan, Langley, Richmond, and right here in Vancouver.
Mayor Gregor Robertson promised more affordable housing and stricter enforcement for negligent landowners in Vision Vancouver's homelessness, affordability, and housing platform on Sunday. At the heart of the platform is a 10-year affordable housing and homeless plan, which includes 38,000 new affordable homes in Vancouver, a task force to strengthen renters' rights, as well as continued support for homeless shelters and seniors' housing. Robertson also pledged an online apartment registry that will allow renters to publicly track landowners' work orders and property violations. He also hopes the registry will pressure landowners to improve their building quickly. According to the mayor, this action is to protect renters and take a hard line against landlords who refuse to upgrade their property to the city standards. Last week, an inquest was held into the deaths of 3 Vancouver men who were killed in a fire on Pandora Street last December. Police determined the fire was a result of a faulty electrical cord.
And in national news, workers at a Walmart in Gatineau, Quebec, have officially decertified from their union. Quebec's Labor Relations Commission removed 150 employees from their union. Now, the Walmart workers first joined the union, the United Food and Commercial Workers Canada, in 2008. But after 2 years of failed negotiations, an arbitrator enforced a collective agreement in 2010. Now, after just over 1 year of enjoying unionized employment, Walmart workers in Quebec have been decertified. In 2010, when the Gatineau workers won their first collective agreement, they were the second group of Walmart employees in North America to actually have one. Now, this decertification leaves only one Canadian Walmart unionized, in Weyburn, Saskatchewan. Those are your local and national headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
I'm gonna be around my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or online at CITR.ca. We're broadcasting live from the Student Union Building right here at UBC. Thank you for being with us. We're going to take a look at some international news right after Ime tells us what we're looking for in the weather this coming week.
Well, it seems like we'll have some cloudy weather with some rain starting on Wednesday, with low pressure system approaching from the Pacific Ocean. Here's your weekday forecast for UBC. Tonight we'll have a few clouds, fog patches developing overnight, windy, low of 3. Tuesday will be cloudy, becoming a mix of sun and cloud in the morning, high of 10. Wednesday will be rainy, low of 5, high of 9. Thursday will be cloudy with 70% chance of showers, low of 4, high of 8. Friday will be cloudy, low of 4, high of 9. Saturday will be cloudy with 60% chance of showers, low of 4, high of 9. Currently, it is 10 degrees, sunny and very windy at UBC. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 11 Celsius and minimum of 4 Celsius. That's your weather for this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Ime Lee.
Thank you, Ime. I guess we need to take advantage of the good weather for the next 24 hours. This might go away for a little while. Anyways, we're going to look at some international headlines.
Quickly, though, before we head into international headlines, we're going to do an update on the missing women inquiry. Commissioner Wally Opal requested that he be given an extra year to give a ruling. He's been granted an additional 6 months to rule on how the investigation was handled. He'll have until July 30th to deliver his findings. But today, Susan Davis testified at these hearings. She was a sex worker in the downtown Eastside area and a former drug addict. She said today that she was raped by a man she believes was Robert Picton. Davis called the police, but they did not arrive to meet her. She also highlighted the systemic issues sex workers and addicts in the neighborhood face. Here's some of what she had to say about her rape and her struggles with addiction. A quick warning, this content may be shocking to some, and you might want to turn this segment off if you are easily offended or have young children with you. Here she is.
So I spoke to 911. They transferred me to somebody else. I'm not sure who. But that person, that officer said, okay, we'll come down there and take a report. Where do you want to meet us? And I had said at 2nd and Main, where the Craftsman collision is there, just on the other side. I spoke to the person again, and they said they would come down and meet me.
Yes.
Again, I'd like to say that, you know, I was out there for an hour. I started to get cold, and it's possibly entirely that they came after I left.
Yes.
But.
Okay. You testified that you think the man who raped you was Mr. Picton. And after he was arrested, I'm guessing that there was a lot of talk within the community of who had had dates with him, who knew him, and the like. Is that right?
Yes.
And obviously it was quite a few years in between the incidents. Yes?
Yes.
And so just to place this, I think you said you believe
that's
it was
right.
Mr. Picton.
But I have no proof of that. And I also realized myself that my eyes could be playing tricks on me, that maybe, and you hear this all the time, that people see a picture and they want it to be the guy that raped them so that their rape is over. That I don't have to fear it, you know? So I am totally aware that I might totally be making this up in my mind, but it is the reality that I live with and drives me to do the things that I do in advocacy. Does that make sense?
Yes, certainly. Certainly it does. Okay, now I want to move to the contextual questions. And I just, you've been asked quite a lot of the context, and really do appreciate your evidence on it, and I only have a few areas which I want to fill it out. I wonder if I can ask you a little bit more about drug use among sex trade workers. And you gave some of this evidence, but how many times a day are drug addicted people, I mean, and drug addicted sex trade workers we're talking here, do they use drugs? I know that it's going to vary, but what's the sort of range? Can you
paint
a picture?
It depends what you're doing. So, like, heroin will last about 3 hours for a dose that's enough to feel, and that dose will vary according to your own tolerance to it. So I had a friend who was using $1,200 worth a day, whereas for me, $100, if I used it all at once, would kill me.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So
yes.
It's very dependent on where you are with it. As well as, I found it was very fluid in how I felt at that particular moment. So if I had a particularly horrible experience, something terrible had just happened, I would immediately go seek crack or whatever I could get my hands on right at that moment and get high right away and continue. And sort of go on a bender when you're triggered, you know,
yes.
you get extremely upset. So I think that it all depends on the moment and the time, but certainly with heroin, it's every 3 hours you need to do it before you start to get sick mm-hmm. and start to feel that dope sickness. And then with crack, I mean, it's really about as soon as it's gone, you want some more. But eventually, when you're crying and feeling so low, you'll eventually cry yourself to sleep 6 or 7 hours later.
So just on heroin for a moment, and is it not uncommon for a person's habit, daily habit, to cost hundreds of dollars a day?
Not uncommon at all.
Yes. And you mentioned $1,200 a day, and that's at the high end,
yeah.
I imagine. And then so what, two to $600 would be?
I would say that's a reasonable sort of a span to put it on.
Yes. And what about with crack? It's cheaper, is it?
Crack is cheaper, but you need more of it. It's mm-hmm. harder to sort of maintain yourself. Like when you have your heroin, you're well, and you don't even really seem that intoxicated mostly unless you've taken too much or it's a different dosage or something like that, a new kind of heroin that's come in. Whereas with crack, you're immediately desperate for more. And so it becomes this sort of chasing the rush, they call it, where you're kind of caught in this loop, trying to get more crack, need more money, get more crack, and you just go in a constant loop until it's over.
And so you're on a cycle of either being high or trying to get high.
Finding the money to do it. But also within that cycle is the violence. So as you're trying to earn the money and things are happening to you, because on the street it's a daily occurrence, you know, this is compounding your need for the drug and driving you even harder to find it.
That was Susan Davis testifying at the Missing Women Inquiry today. She was speaking on a man that she believes was Robert Picton, who raped her years ago, and on her experience as a sex worker and a drug addict in the Downtown East Side. She is now an advocate for sex worker and addicts in the neighborhood. And now we are going to move on to international headlines.
The U.S. government has cut off tens of millions of dollars in annual funding to the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, after it voted to admit Palestine as a full member. Victoria Nuland, the U.S. State Department spokeswoman, said payments to the Paris-based organization would be stopped immediately. She said Washington would not make the $60 million payment it planned to deliver to UNESCO in November. UNESCO depends heavily on U.S. funding. Washington provides about 22% of its budget, but has survived without it in the past. The Palestinian bid received 107 yes votes during a UNESCO meeting in Paris, with 14 countries voting against and 52 abstaining, enough to satisfy a two-thirds majority of those countries present and voting. Full membership to Palestine. This grants full membership to Palestine, which has had observer status since 1974. Riyad al-Malki, the Palestinian foreign minister, said the vote would help to preserve cultural heritage in Palestine. It is a small victory for the Palestine Liberation Organization, which filed a bid last month for full membership at the UN. The bid has been stalled for weeks at the UN Security Council and will likely face a U.S. veto when it comes to a vote.
Libya's interim authorities, the National Transitional Council, have named Tripoli academic Abdurrahim Al-Kaib as Libya's new prime minister. The National Transitional Council made the announcement days after declaring the country's freedom following the death of Colonel Gaddafi. Mr. Abdurrahim Al-Kaib, an academic specializing in electrical engineering and based in Tripoli, beat 8 other candidates to receive 26 of the 51 votes from members of the National Transitional Council. He replaces Mahmoud Jibril, who said he would stand down after the Declaration of Freedom on October 23rd. The announcement came just a few hours before NATO's mission in Libya was formally due to end. At 1 minute to midnight, Libyan time, on Monday, earlier, NATO Chief Anders Fogh Rasmussen paid a visit to Tripoli and said the organization was proud to have played its part during the uprising. In the past 7 months, NATO warplanes flew 26,000 sorties, including more than 9,600 strike missions, destroying more than 1,000 tanks, vehicles, and guns. He said NATO could continue to help with defense and security reform, but that it was time for the United Nations to take the lead in international assistance for Libya.
Ahmed Haroun, the governor for Sudan's South Kordofan state, said that hundreds of rebels have been killed following clashes with the Sudanese army. He said more than 700 rebels of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement were killed when the army repelled an attack on the city of Taludi. The rebels have not commented on the claims, but previously accused the army of ethnic cleansing in the oil-rich area. Mr. Haroun has been charged by the International Criminal Court for alleged war crimes in Darfur, where he was once the governor. The SPLM, the political power in South Sudan, denies Sudan's claims that it is backing the rebels, even though it fought alongside the northern rebels during Sudan's decades-long civil war.
Happy birthday, 7th billion baby! Happy birthday to Danica in the Philippines, Nargis in India, and Peter in Russia. Competing organizations have named those three babies the official 7th billion person born. The United Nations Population Organization declared the world's population reached this landmark today on Halloween. UN officials allow for a margin of error of 6 months, so feel free to continue celebrating overpopulation for the next half year. But you might not want to celebrate too hard. Overpopulation and environmental concerns are abound as people reflect on the issues that come with too many people on the planet. By 2045, global population is projected to reach 9 billion. A billion people go hungry each day. Environmental strains are worsening, though not with the same impact globally. Each additional Briton has the carbon footprint of 22 Malawians. If you'd like to learn some more about what 7 billion means for our planet, National Geographic just wrote a series on the subject. You can learn more by going to nationalgeographic.com/2011/01/7-billion. Or you could Google 7 billion National Geographic, and that may be easier.
Those are your international headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
And just to give you a quick update on the upcoming shows on CITR 101.9, at 6 p.m., you'll be listening to Sore Throats Clapping Hands, your weekly dose of rogue folk music. At 7:30 p.m., is Exploding Head Movies, where you can listen to every cinematic soundtrack ever made. And at 9 p.m., you would have your jazz show for 2.5 hours, which sounds great. Stay tuned, and we'll be back with more news.
The Biltmore Cabaret is your home for great live music in Vancouver.
October is sure to be a busy month at the Biltmore. On October 6th, catch bands Hollow Moon, The Bleeding Hearts, and Pineapple, a supergroup featuring members of the SSRIs, Portage in the Main, and Prairie Cat. October 21st, jam out with Daydream Vacation, indie rocker Zeus, and local favorites Sun Wizard. For fans of the New Pornographers, you won't want to miss band member Catherine Calder and special guest Anime Bell on October 27th. To round out your month, October 29th brings the band Nurses all the way up from Portland to share the stage with Dominant Legs.
For more information on these and other shows, including how to get tickets, visit BiltmoreCabaret.com.
Got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Where else can you see Hollywood blockbusters, midnight cult classics, indie films, live music, burlesque, stand-up comedy, poetry slams, and live sporting events all at your local theater? The Rio Theater, voted number one in East Vancouver, your neighborhood indie theater that promotes all things cool.
On October 15th, come out to Chad Van Galen live in concert. The Rum Diary will run October 28th through the 31st. And don't forget about all the great Halloween-themed movies that run at midnight each Friday night.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
For more information, visit riotheatre.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Up next, we will be having an in-studio discussion with Courtney Loftus, the media coordinator from Stand UBC, and Simon from the Africa-Canada Coalition.
Africa-Canada Accountability Coalition. But good
there
try.
You go. Or AC-AC, as they colloquially call it. Well, Stand UBC is a student-run organization here at UBC, and their aim is to promote discussion on ongoing genocides around the world and to sort of provoke government action on those events, horrifying events. So go ahead, Courtney, and tell us a bit about how this started.
Okay, well, Stand is actually a national-led student organization, and UBC is a chapter of that. It actually started with a specific focus on Darfur in the 2004-2006. We consider it a genocide. The UN considers it a conflict. Recently, we've expanded the mandate to include the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and so we've also expanded our mandate to other crimes against humanity as well as genocide, specifically. And here at UBC, we've tried to promote awareness on campus, like with our November 3rd seminar on sexual violence in the Congo, which is going to be a learning experience for all of us. And we partnered up with ACAC for this, and we're really excited about that. And also, Stand UBC engages with MPs around the area, such as Joyce Murray, and we do a little bit of fundraising for the Darfur Stoves Project as well.
That's great. Well, Simon, tell us a bit about how the AC-AC started.
Sure. The Africa-Canada Accountability Coalition, ACAC, or AC-AC, as we call it more casually, started as the result of a political science project of four UBC undergraduate students around 2.5 years ago, that they were tasked with looking at a conflict and what Canada could do about it. And they studied the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And they had two major findings. One was that there is immense human suffering in the DRC, particularly the experiences of women. And second, that Canada had a long and extensive history in the Congo that no one really talks about. And from this, these students decided that they had to do something, and they created this research and advocacy organization that is AC-AC. And then I jumped on board several months after. So that's how we came about.
Wait, could you tell us a bit about how Canada was involved in the DRC?
Yeah, well, Canada has a, as I said, extensive history dating all the way back to Congolese independence. But the more recent conflict, which is what gets a lot of attention in the media, and unfortunately not so much attention in the international community, started in 1996. And Canada has had a long role in that, from things like supporting the interests of our corporate citizens over the interests of women. So, for example, when it came to the peace deal, which was going to be about settling elections as well, the voices of women who were disproportionately affected by the conflict were not included. And that's just one example, and there are many, many others that I could talk about how Canada has had a history in this conflict that we think puts a responsibility, well, that Canada has to take ownership of its responsibility in the DRC.
Could you maybe talk about the role of mining?
Yes, that's a very popular one, and that's been a very popular issue. An issue that's often been linked to sexual violence, and the links around that can sometimes become very complex. Canada is the second largest mining investor in the DRC after South Africa. They're the largest Western investor. And often, people who are familiar with the conflict in the Congo or the term conflict minerals, there's this idea that armed groups profit from selling these minerals and these armed groups rape. And there, it is true that some Canadian companies have are active in the Congo, more in the southern region, which is more peaceful. And it is true that there's some Canadian companies that are active in the eastern region, where there has been more conflict. And there are some reports that have shown that some Canadian mining companies need to take more due diligence about working with vulnerable communities. Now, has there been specifically collusion between Canadian mining companies and armed groups? We really can't say. It's so complex and information there. I mean, you have to take everything with a grain of salt that there's no way to know. But what is clear is that there needs to be more due diligence done, and the Canadian government needs to be able to say, Canadian mining companies, if you're going to choose to work in these vulnerable communities, you need to make sure that you look after X, Y, and Z. And another important point that I just add to that is that I wouldn't want to demonize mining investment, because the Congolese economy is very fragile and Canada's mining investments there are very important, and a lot of people's livelihoods depend on that.
Great. Well, bringing the discussion back to UBC's, Courtney, tell us a bit about how did professors support your organization when it was first started? Did professors vocally, you know, say, hey, this is great, we'd love to, you know, talk to you about this, or maybe offer our knowledge and, you know, our resources to you?
Well, I actually only joined last year, just to make that clear. I'm only my second year at UBC, so. But last year, we actually had a seminar on the impact of journalism and how that has affected the crisis in Darfur specifically, and the Sudan as a greater whole. And we actually had two classes with international relations professors come and bring their classes as a part of their class, so right, to get them engaged. So I would say that we definitely have support on campus from the faculty.
So what about, you spoke about MP involvement. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Joyce Murray. What are some of the things she's taken an initiative on?
Well, last year we had a panel called Debating Darfur, and its focus was on the looming separation of Sudan and South Sudan, which happened on July 9th. And Joyce Murray actually came and spoke as one of our panelists. And we had her, a professor from UBC, and a refugee from Sudan come and speak to us. And it was really interesting and really inspiring. And so we've definitely had a lot of contact with Joyce Murray, and she's definitely like been engaged with what we've been doing. As for policy recommendations, she's actually made recommendations with regards to the Congo and sexual violence in the Congo. So she definitely listens to what we have to say, which is awesome.
So when you say policy recommendations, does that mean these, her recommendations are applied? Are they eventually applied, hopefully?
Well, STAND has, we've adjusted our policy recommendations since South Sudan separated from Sudan, because
right,
there's been increasing conflict along the border region. Basically, what we want from Canada is to facilitate discussion between the leaders, and try and come up with some sort of resolution that they can implement on their own.
Are you talking about the African Union as well?
We're specifically talking about Omar al-Bashir and Salva Kiir Mayardit, the presidents of the two countries.
Okay.
We think that Canada has the capacity and the manpower to facilitate a discussion like that, and we would obviously prefer to see a coherent sit-down and peaceful agreement rather than necessary intervention, because the conflict in Darfur itself is over, but the root causes of the genocide haven't been addressed. And so we think that it's really important to do that. As for policy recommendations, STAND has implemented a 1-800 genocide line, and you can call it from any phone in Canada and leave a message for the Prime Minister's office, the Minister of Foreign Affairs office, or the Leader of the Opposition's office. And you can leave them a message telling them what you think about the situation and what you think they should do about it. And so it's really awesome to have a direct line like that.
Simon, I read a bit about the ACAC's efforts I read a bit about it in the UBC, where they set up, I can't recall what it was. My research is so bad, I apologize. But it was something about people, people from the Lord's Liberation Army.
Resistance.
Yeah.
Yeah, from that.
They were switching sides because they heard your radio transmissions. Was that the ACAC?
LRA. No, I think that was another group. And I don't know if this was the
specifically. Oh, sorry, that was Invisible Children.
Invisible Children, I was about to say.
I don't think
like,
that LRA was just Simon. That'd be great if they did, but...
Yeah, yeah. Or would it? I don't know.
I mean, I thought that was absolutely amazing that people from the Army actually listened to the broadcast and said, hey, I have to rethink about what I'm doing and, hand myself over Did you hear about this?
Yeah, we did hear about this. I think that it's really impressive how one NGO is able to have such a great effect, and it's also very impressive that they were able to create this positive result. However, ACAC always likes to look at all the externalities of any policy and any maybe negative consequences that can come from what may initially look as a good idea. And my thoughts are just always with, what about the people who try and escape listening to these radio broadcasts? And of course, often the punishment for trying to escape from these groups is death or torture. And I just think that, what if these often children are putting themselves in very dangerous positions by listening to these radio broadcasts? And I can't, I don't know enough about it to speak on it, but I just would hope that that is being addressed by, and that is being in the mind of the people who are doing this initiative.
So, Courtney, tell us a bit about what the current situation in Darfur is, because, I mean, we hear a lot about it in the media, but nobody ever talks about what's going on and why it's why things are happening.
What happened? Yeah. Well, the actual crisis in Darfur happened from 2004 to 2006, and as you may know, the government-backed Jean Jouid went into villages and systematically destroyed the villages and the people inside them, and it was a mass atrocity. It was really awful. The Jean Jouid are not massacring civilians anymore, but approximately 2 million people are still displaced internally within Sudan itself, and there are about 300,000 refugees in neighboring Chad, right beside Darfur, and they don't feel like it's safe to come home yet, because all of these tensions that are underlying between rebel groups and the civilians in Darfur are still present. There's a lot of poverty there. There's a lot of destruction. There's a lot of insecurity. There's a lot of distrust, and so those problems need to be addressed. And one way that I personally think that it could be addressed would be al-Bashir showing up to his indictment at the International Criminal Court, because no one can feel safe coming home when the president who enacted those atrocities is still running their country.
What are you guys hoping to accomplish on Thursday?
For me personally, as a member of STAND, STAND is very interested in creating policy recommendations with regards to what's going on in the Congo, but our UBC chapter does not feel informed enough about it, so that's why we've partnered up with ACAC to learn about what's going on in the Congo, to develop a real understanding about it. And personally, I'm really, really excited for it, and I hope that other people at UBC will be excited about it too and will want to come out and learn about what's going on in the Congo, especially with the sexual violence. And then we have another seminar on child soldiers later this month, so...
Yeah, I guess my take would be on it that it's going to be on sexual violence in the DRC, and specifically the title is going to be Why Soldiers Rape. And the issue of rape used as a weapon of war is something that transcends the conflicts in Congo and Darfur. And I think it's a very complex issue. I think it's an issue that's often very sensationalized, sometimes oversimplified. And what ACAC would like to get out of the discussion at the Global Lounge at 6 on Thursday is going to be a teaching moment, and that people are going to really come and learn. And I want people to appreciate the complexity of these issues when they walk out of that room, and I want people to leave with a lot of questions, maybe more questions than answers. And yeah, basically we want people to go and be challenged. So if you're looking for that,
I think one of the reasons behind its complexity is that most of the time the victims are severely psychologically misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Like, most people hear about this in the news, they see a couple of videos, they see some sound clips, but they don't understand the psychology of the victims, right? Because that cannot be expressed in a video, right? So are you guys going to talk about this in your seminar?
Absolutely. The themes that we're going to be covering is impunity. We are actually going to be talking about why soldiers rape. And another really important theme that STAND is actually going to be taking on, and I think a theme that unfortunately is usually neglected, is the voices of survivors, and that not all survivors are helpless, and that there are many Congolese women who are actually forming organizations and helping themselves, and to really challenge that narrative of just these helpless women.
Organizations on a local level?
On organizations on a local level, yeah. And yeah, STAND is going to be talking about that.
And You spoke about the hotline, for example. Can that hotline be applied at a local level? Do you think that's possible eventually in the future? Like, can local journalists or people who have some, or maybe even a cell phone, for example, call that hotline and say, hey, something's happening, help us? Or I understand that the system is very, very, mismanaged there, but is it possible in the future to have a hotline applied locally?
Like,
do you see
in Sudan, you mean? Or
in the DRC, in Sudan?
I would love to see that.
Absolutely. That would be, you know.
That would be amazing. First of all, you would have to engage with your MPs at a local level to convince them that it would be worth your time. Secondly, you'd have to convince al-Bashir that it was okay for them to have a hotline with that in his country. So I think that would be a long ways down the road, but it would be a great thing to happen.
Yeah, definitely a long way.
It's a bit of a long shot, though.
Martin, more questions?
Where is it on Thursday? Where do we go?
I was going to mention that.
It's
let me tell our audience right here. The STAN seminar called Why Do Soldiers Rape will take place on Thursday, November 3rd at 5 p.m. at the Global Lounge in Marine Drive Residence on Lower Mall, I believe, at the UBC campus. And I'm assuming you guys will all be there, of course, with how many people do you expect to see there?
Many people who are interested in learning about the Congo.
Absolutely.
For sure.
That's great. Well, thank you guys so much for being with us. Well,
thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Great. We'd love to talk more about this, you know, in future events, and keep us updated, because we'd love to hear from you again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, that was Courtney Loftus and Simon from STAN UBC and the ACAC, respectively. Their seminar will take place on November 3rd at 5 p.m. at the Global Lounge in Marine Drive. Well, please stay with us. We'll be right back after a couple of PSAs.
Biltmore Cabaret is your home for great live music in Vancouver.
October is sure to be a busy month at the Biltmore. On October 6th, catch bands Hollow Moon, The Bleeding Hearts, and Pineapple, a supergroup featuring members of the SSRIs, Portage in the Main, and Prairie Cat. October 21st, jam out with Daydream Vacation, indie rocker Zeus, and local favorites Sun Wizard. For fans of the New Pornographers, you won't want to miss band member Catherine Calder and special guest Anime Bell on October 27th. To round out your month, October 29th brings the band Nurses all the way up from Portland to share the stage with Dominant Legs.
For more information on these and other shows, including how to get tickets, visit BiltmoreCabaret.com.
How do you write a good magazine article?
Discorder is that magazine published by CITR 101.9 FM. In it, you'll find reviews of concerts and albums, stories about bands and artists, comics, and more, including a comprehensive guide to CITR's program.
In the October issue of Discorder, you can read up on great bands like Aunts and Uncles, Ghost House, and Yukon Blonde, cruise the oral history of Mint Records, and enjoy the fabulous cover story of Shimmering Stars. And don't miss the contributors' meeting September 29th at 6 p.m. in the CITR Lounge. Come one, come all.
Discorder is available all over the fine city of Vancouver. For a complete list of distribution locations, why not go online to discorder.ca.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Next up, we'll have a little small segment from FSRN regarding the population...
7 billion babies.
I guess we just go straight to the segment if we have nothing to say about...
Mm-hmm. I think, all I gotta say is there are a lot of people. So let's let...
Sorry.
Let's let FSRN give us more.
In the Philippines, her name was Danica. In India, it was Nargis. And in Russia, a little boy named Peter. Shortly after midnight, multiple countries symbolically welcomed the 7 billionth person to the world. But while families are celebrating, some are using this population landmark as an opportunity to raise awareness about the demographic growth. The rising population could put pressure on scarce resources like arable land, food, and water supply, and even increase the potential for conflicts. In Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, authorities are struggling to keep the population at a manageable level. FSRN's Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
Pedestrians, vendors, motorbikes, and buses crowd a busy road in Lagos, Nigeria's largest city. The scene is common throughout the city, where one can see and feel the country's population pressures. With more people comes more pressure on infrastructure like roads and housing. United Nations figures suggest that Nigeria's current population of 163 million could jump to 730 million by the end of the century to become the third highest in the world, behind only India and China. In the poor and densely populated neighborhood of Makoko in Lagos, children are busy playing. The sheer number of children is another indication of the country's population growth, which is especially high in poor neighborhoods. I spoke with one of the parents who lives here.
I like women a lot. If any woman I went out with becomes pregnant, I will allow her to give birth to the baby. And if she wants to marry me, there's no problem with that at all.
Gebete Peter was born into a polygamous home. He is also a polygamist. At 40 years old, he already has 4 wives and 12 children. Polygamy, which is a widespread cultural practice in Nigeria, especially in poor neighborhoods like Makoko, is one of the factors responsible for the country's rapid population growth. Besides polygamy, population growth is also high because most women lack knowledge of reproductive health. Additionally, because of religious and cultural factors, many families shun contraceptives. Matthew Kusika is involved in a family planning awareness campaign. He says vital decisions on issues like how many children to have and when to have them are made by men. In many African cultures, a woman is required to allow her husband to make such decisions on her behalf.
Most of the women, they are not educated, so they must accept what the man said, because the man is the head of the family. He is the one who makes decisions. So even if some women, you ask them, where do you want to seek a medical care? Then we say, where my husband told me to go. You know why? Because he is the head of the family. So now, when coming to a family planning, without a man, you can never do it.
As the population grows, the community changes. Joseph Blabo, who was born in Makoko, says he has seen increasing violence and unemployment over the years.
Yes, the population increase here has really changed a lot of things. Now, some years back, when I was very young, there was no crime, everywhere was safe. But now, we're living with fear that this the touts in the area could start a fight, and the next thing you hear on your door is bow, 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 to break into your house. They just steal your things or wound any of your family member. So I believe the increase in population, you know, has caused, has bringing crime, because these youths don't have work. They don't have job. All they do is roam about the streets in the day, smoking Indian hemp, causing trouble.
The problems in this neighborhood are replicated around Nigeria and without more access to birth control and family planning. Nigeria is on track to reach 400 million people by 2050. Some NGOs warn the growth here and in other African countries will hamper efforts to reach the UN's 2015 Millennium Development Goals, which seek to provide jobs, shelter, clean water, and quality education for all. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Tuesday, November 1st, come out for Shout for Somalia. This event's goal is to raise funds for Somalia during this time of crisis, especially with the recent famine that hit the country in July. All proceeds raised will go to Hope International, a Canadian nonprofit currently involved in serving those in the Horn of Africa. Entrance is by donation, doors are at 9, and the show starts at 9:30. Again, that's Shout for Somalia, a fundraiser at Calabash Bistro, Tuesday, November 1st.
And that was the news. News 101 at CITR 101.9.
It's our program for October 31st. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. Or you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. For more news, join us right here on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lumlin.
And I'm Ariel Fournier.
Today's program was produced entirely by CJ, and he did an outstanding job because of it. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands with Robert Privet, and have a good night.
And good luck.